I was in a coma for 6 weeks while the doctors told my wife I was going to die. When I woke up, she told me the most fantastic story. My team kept running the business without me. Freelancers reached out to my team and said, "We will do whatever it takes as long as Craig's in the hospital." I consider that the greatest accomplishment in my career. My name is Craig Andrews, and this is the Leaders and Legacies podcast, where we talk to leaders creating an impact beyond themselves. At the end of today's interview, I'll tell you how you can be the next leader featured on this show. Today, I want to welcome Kimberly Carlson. She is the founder of US Beacon. She leads a team that is focused on improving healthcare affordability. Their mission is to meticulously review and optimize medical bills, ensuring significant savings for employers and healthcare plans while upholding strict compliance with laws and regulations. If you run a business and you provide healthcare for your employees, you've probably been noticing that your premiums are going up double digits year on year. That will eventually overtake your revenue if it hasn't already. So this is something you have to get in control if you're running a business and if you want to retain good employees. Kimberly, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Craig. I really appreciate it.
I've been looking forward to this. And, you know, I think you and I both have, you know, one of the reasons I've invited a whole bunch of people like you on the podcast is my own personal journey, my 3 months in the hospital and all the aftermath after that, running up $2 million worth of healthcare bills. I just saw incredible brokenness in the system. Mm-hmm. And I was like, we have to do something about it. And I think you had something happen to your husband that kind of was your motivation.
That's right, Craig. So my husband was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. It was metastatic.
Let me pause. Metastatic means what?
It means it spread all over his body. Yes. Yeah. Do you want me to back?
And No. That's good.
Sure. No. Okay. So he was diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic bladder cancer. Metastatic meaning it had spread into his lymph nodes. And typically when it's spread into your lymph nodes, they give you 2 years to live. Well, they did with this particular cancer. So when we realized we had cancer, it just infiltrated every single bit of our lives. You have doctor's visits, hospital stays. You're constantly just, nothing is ever normal when you're got a cancer patient, when you're living with a cancer patient. So when we were told he had 2 years to live, I just couldn't accept that. I knew we were in the biggest fight for our life. Luckily, we had a friend that was an oncologist that said, "Hey, you've got a death sentence. If you do not have someone do a surgery on you, you will die. You've got to go in and take everything out." And what he was meaning when he said everything, he meant his bladder, his prostate, and his lymph nodes that could have been affected by the cancer. So we went to all the major institutions, and none of them would touch him because it would hurt their statistics. So luckily, he was on the board.
Yeah. What?
We called all those institutions that say they'll cure cancer, but when I told them it was stage 4, they said, "We can't take him in."
It would hurt their numbers?
Absolutely, because he was going to die. In most doctors' eyes, he was supposed to die.
This is the honorable profession.
Right.
We're talking about the honorable profession that won't try to save somebody's life because it would hurt their record.
This was our experience. This was our experience. I don't know if it's everyone's, but when he was that far gone, they thought I should just chemo him and let him go. That's what that was told. Kim, you need to just chemo him.
Which is a miserable life in itself.
Right. Right. And I was pregnant at the time with our son. So, and I had a 4-year-old daughter. So, we fired that doctor and we found a doctor that, and I'm not downing doctors by any means. They have saved my husband's life. So The odds were stacked against us, but by the grace, we found a doctor that said, I will do the surgery because he was on the board of a cancer center and he told us he would do the surgery, but it's a Hail Mary, is what he told me. And I said, I don't care. I want you to go in and do everything you can to save my husband. So they went in, did the surgery. I watched, advocated for every aspect of his care, from his chemo to his meds to well, every single thing they did, I was in there watching, making sure it was all done right. And by the grace of God, he's here with us today.
Now,
Thank you.
how many years ago was this diagnosis made?
So Craig, I know it was my son is 18 and I was 4 months pregnant. We had just found out we had a boy. So we're talking 19 years ago.
And he was
I'm
given a
now.
two-year death sentence, and here he is.
Here he is because we stood up. We were a voice. He had a voice. And also, we found someone where we were not just a number, we were a name. And I think that means a lot in a system, a big system. You don't go in, if you're just that number that's called out, like next in line, you're not seen as much as if you are a name and a person and they're taking care of you.
You know, when I was in my coma, on the ventilator, presumably gonna die from COVID, my wife told me about she met some of the other families, and she told me about one family. It was pregnant. The wife was pregnant and had a bunch of kids, and she just felt horrible. I just can't imagine the terror you went through of, oh my, I mean, just all the things that you had to process. You're about to lose your husband. You're about to raise a baby by yourself. About to.
You really cannot fathom until you go through it about every picture you take, you just think about this could be the last. I tried to not let my mind go there, but I tried because I wanted my daughter to see. I didn't want her to know as much. They gave us a video to show her, but I wasn't going to approach that with her yet because we weren't there. And in my mind, I was going to save him, or not save him, the doctors were, but we were going to try everything we had. So I had to keep my mind focused on the present. But at the time that I would go down the path of really breaking down would be in the shower. It's the only time I had alone, you know? And so that's when I would really be able to get all the fear and sadness out and then have to go back and present myself because my daughter had started kindergarten and I had to be the mom that was, you know, the parent that comes up to the school and does everything for their kids, because I wanted to be that role and I wanted to be the advocate role. I wanted to be everything. So it was a difficult time, but I learned so much through it. So I wouldn't change it for anything.
And I think that's, sorry, it's, I mean, that just hit me emotionally because it's so hard to keep that good face for your daughter. My wife, one day in her journal, it was the day they finally transferred me out of the ICU. And she said how she had always tried, she talked to me through my whole coma, and I heard her, and she told me about, how she had always tried to keep it positive when she was in the room. And the day they transferred me out of the ICU, and she's looking at my withered body, she said, I just couldn't hold back anymore. And I just broke out crying. I don't know how you held it together.
It's hard. It was hard. I'm getting emotional now too. So, but it was difficult.
Yeah, I bet. Oh my goodness, that's terrifying.
I wanted to be there for my daughter though. I didn't want her life to change because she was so young, and that could have really put a it just could have hurt her emotionally really bad at that young of an age. You know, they say your kids' personalities form in those younger years, and I didn't want her to see me as a sad mom. You know, I wanted her to be grounded in faith and also to feel security.
Yeah.
So it was difficult.
Oh, well, good for you. I mean, I've never been in those shoes. I just can't imagine.
It, yeah, when we when I had my son, it was my husband was bald at the time because he had been doing chemo, but I looked over at him and he was holding my son, but I looked at him and that's the first time I've looked at him and he really looked like a cancer patient. And when I say that, in the utmost respect for cancer patients, because nobody knows what they're going through.
Yeah.
But they have no eyelashes. They're kind of yellowish and bald-headed and very frail. But to see that moment of him holding my son was just amazing.
Oh, wow.
To
Wow.
be there. So
I bet that's a treasured
I make
photograph.
it through this podcast,
Yeah.
Greg. Oh, it's bringing me back to
I bet that's a treasured photo of you holding him holding your
him holding.
son.
It is. It, but you know, when I see it, I see bringing that photo back, I see all, it brings up all the fear I was going through at the time because he's headed and he's, but he's holding my son, but it's a lot of fear that'll come back. It's almost like a post-traumatic stress, that I see in that picture. So sometimes it's hard for me to look at it.
Yeah. No, I get that. I think it's hard for people that haven't been through that kind of trauma, it's hard to understand where it just sneaks up on you. And I mean, for me, my sister-in-law posted a picture of a train riding down tracks next to a mountain, next to a lake. And when I saw that photo, it immediately took me back to my coma and just, it was like, it was PTSD. It was a dream I had in my coma. And it's wild how those things just come out of the blue and they hit you.
It really is. It can be a certain smell. There's so much you remember when you're going through that moment at that time that it can definitely bring you back and give you that feeling that just kind of guts you.
Yeah.
But it also gives you a feeling of so much thankfulness and just, why us? Why did you allow us? And then you realize you've got purpose and meaning to be here and to be able to tell your story. Like you have your, such purpose in telling your story.
Yeah. No, and I think, I mean, kind of speaking of that, it's so in the process of doing that, you kind of became an expert in the medical system.
Well, I got my degree in radiologic technology. So I'd already been in the system of quite a bit because I worked at a hospital. But then when we became the patient on the other side, it was a different level of being in the system. And yes, I had to watch every single thing. Not that you have to, I don't want to say that, but as a patient, you have to make sure you're advocating for yourself.
100%. And I don't think people realize that.
They
The
do
things that
not.
get skipped, I almost missed a blood transfusion. If my
That
wife hadn't been there, I would have never gotten that transfusion. I don't think
that
people
you
appreciate that.
they do not they don't realize because nobody knows you better than your wife or your spouse or whomever, your kids. They know if something is off, and so you know when something needs to be done because you're the one watching the charts, watching everything that goes in their mouth, watching. So you have to kind of be that annoying nag that goes and lets them know, hey, get down here and take care of, my husband. So I did that all the way through. And I was eight months. Well, no, but he was in the hospital several times, but I waddled down to get him at the time. So.
So what was kind of the big, so you started, you were in radiology before as a provider, and now you're on the patient side. What were the kind of the big ahas for you at that moment?
That seeing so many families going through what we went through and being in a waiting room and knowing that my husband was with Merrill Lynch, she was senior vice president over the institutional side. So he was diversified, or our financials were diversified, but there were a lot that weren't. And I talked to him and I was with them. You know who's going to be at chemo that day or who's in the hospital beside you because you're in it. for a year, basically. So you know everybody. A lot weren't. A lot lost their family members, and a lot couldn't afford to continue on with their treatment. So it started making sense to me that I might could do something. There is purpose why he is here. There is purpose why, and I don't know anyone's faith, but I'm a believer in Jesus. And there's purpose in, now how can I use that purpose? And the purpose is for me to be able to help others navigate the system.
Which is so incredibly confusing.
It is so confusing, and it's built to fa make you feel like you're failing the system. So you have to have, I think it is important for people to find someone that knows what they're doing and to help them, because a lot of people will just, if I would have just listened to that, those major hospitals that we see advertising, I don't want to name names, but they're very well-known hospitals. If I would have just listened to them and hung up the phone and said, okay, you just have 2 years to live, I wouldn't have a husband and my kids wouldn't have a father.
Wow. The one of my big lessons was I had to go in and question everything. I mean, when the bills started coming through, I mean, it was just crazy. One of the things that they tried to charge me or present as not covered by insurance was when I was in the hospital, and I forget which surgery it was, so I had a few, at least two surgeries. One was to put my trach in, and the other was to put my feeding tube in my stomach. One of those, they didn't want to pay the anesthesiologist because the anesthesiologist was out of network. I'm like, I was in the hospital, which was in
Same
network.
place, right?
And I was like, I didn't make that choice.
Yeah, and most people don't know to look at that and to question it, right?
Yeah. Well, and then there was a claim that the anesthesiologist never filed with my insurance. They've sold that debt twice and sent bill collectors after me to get that, and they never filed it with the insurance. And for those that don't know, the law says they have to file it with your insurance by the first day of the 11th month after your treatment, or they never get to come after you for it. But they've sold it to two different debt collectors to try to get money out of me.
Have you, what do you do about, what are you doing about that?
So in the process, I had to figure out how to become an expert at medical law. And thank goodness we live in the era of ChatGPT, because I can say, please write a letter in accordance to with this code to respond, and ChatGPT will draft a letter that sounds reasonably professional and will tell them. But you have to know how to direct ChatGPT. You have to know about the law. You have to know about these things.
You do.
And it's just crazy. But so kind of coming back to you, you're helping folks navigate all this. You're helping employers navigate
We
that.
are. We're helping self-funded plans, and as what we do is we review medical claims. We find ineligible charges. Those are the charges that are typically unbundled from a certain CPT code, which is code on a bill that when they're charging or when they're putting your bill together, they're going to have CPT codes on it that are just going to explain the procedure. It's a procedure code. So we go in, we take those procedure codes off that should not be there. Those are ones that, let's say that you've already paid for your surgery, but they add in sterilization, or they add in a warming blanket, or they add in a pill cutter. You know, things like that that shouldn't be on the bill, we take it out. And typically we find around 20 to 40% of ineligible charges on every claim we review for in-network. And on the network, we can go up to 70% and above. That's how much extra is on there that should not be on the claim. And if you think about that, that adds up to a whole lot of dollars, especially by the end of the year, and then the premiums raise. People just don't understand the trickle-down effect that that has with their employers.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's a, I forgot, there's one of those ratios that if you exceed it, your next year's premiums are just going to go up a stupid amount.
Right. Like that we've seen this year happen with premiums
Yeah.
ridiculously going up. So I go on to Reddit a lot. I don't know if you ever go on there, but I read just personal stories because I like to see where people are. And I like to know how to meet people where they are. And so they're just talking about how they're not even able to afford insurance this year because it's
Yeah.
gone up so much. Or they can't do a family plan. They've got to just do an individual.
Boy, and then that doesn't that suck? Okay, who are we going to insure?
Right, exactly.
But so how is it that you work with companies to get this under control?
Right, so we go to self-funded plans. We're typically we do municipal leagues, we do any self-funded plan, school districts, unions. We go in pre or post-payment and we audit their claims. A lot of times the networks or BUCOs, TPAs will not let us go in prepayment. So if that occurs, we go in post-payment and we go collect the pay overpayments. We have been doing this for a long time. We have found one clean claim. And when I say clean, that means there were no errors. But the claim did have a $5 charge on it, but I call that clean, an extra charge. So that's clean to me. So our appeals rate is less than 1%. We've never lost an appeal. So it's just a lot of times, intentional or not, it happens. Coding departments get busy. They throw on codes on a bill, it gets sent out. And it's typically paid. Your carrier's probably going to tell you they have a review party already in place, like ours. But if it's owned by them, I would say you should have an independent to be nice.
Well, I mean, here's an example from my journey. There's a company, I wouldn't say their name on air, but they are a criminal organization. And the reason I say that they're a criminal organization is in 2018, they settled a lawsuit with the DOJ. They paid the DOJ $10 million and they admitted to knowingly billing people for equipment that they never delivered.
Yeah.
They're a criminal organization. They charged me for oxygen. For 2 years, I was never their customer. I got oxygen from someone else.
Wow.
And I was off oxygen for well over a year while they were still billing me for oxygen that they never provided in the first place.
That happens all the time too.
Yeah.
It was sickening. Yeah. And
And
you're right, there's a lot of those criminal organizations in healthcare, unfortunately.
well, I can think of one pharmaceutical company that has been convicted of so many felonies that if they were a person, they'd be spending life in jail.
I have to agree with you. There's several pharmaceutical companies that have definitely been had the lawsuits, but you don't hear about some of them as much because they go to arbitration and you don't. They hot settle it under the table. So they have those arbitration clauses in their agreements.
Yeah. So what does it, so let's say I have a company that's, let's say, doing 10 million in revenue and I'm providing employee healthcare for my employees. How much money, if I brought you on, how much money on average would you bring back to my $10 million company?
So let's say you spent 10 million in claims. So we're only going to review 30% of that because 30% is going to be your 10,000 and above. And typically, if you go below 10,000, it's really just kind of your contractual doctor's visits or something like that. And you're not going to find as much savings. But we would typically, at the end of the year, it would be 10% of overall spend. That would be very conservative. So you would save 10% of your overall spend.
That's pretty big.
Yeah, it can end up being every month, we bill monthly, let's say, to a lot of our clients. Every month, when we give the percentage of what we saved, it's typically between 20 and 40% for the month.
Well, and when we think about how health plans are quickly becoming the second or maybe third line item in the budget, in any company's budget, to be able to tackle that. And not only that, but a budget item that's probably rising faster than revenue. To be able
Every plan should be looking over. They look at every pencil, every piece of paper. They account for everything in a business, but they do not account for the health plan dollars. They don't look over them because they just trust.
Wow. Well, Kimberly, this is just, I mean, obviously, you and I have talked, we're both passionate about this. I think people need to reach out to you and at least have a conversation. How can they reach you?
They can reach me on LinkedIn or go to our website, us-beacon.com.
Okay.
So we have an info button on there, and if they email that, we get back to them pretty quickly.
Well, I'm so thankful you were there for your husband. I'm so thankful for what you're doing. Thank you for coming on Leaders and Legacies.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. I think you and I both share something in common, and we have a passion because of what we've been through. So I appreciate it.
This is Craig Andrews. I want to thank you for listening to the Leaders and Legacies podcast. We're looking for leaders to share how they're making an impact beyond themselves. If that's you, please go to alliesforme.com/guest and sign up there. If you got something out of this interview, we would love you to share this episode on social media. Just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post it on the socials. If you know someone who would be a great guest, tag them on social media and let them know about the show, including the hashtag Leaders and Legacies. I love seeing your posts and suggestions. We are regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you don't miss anything, please go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me. It means a lot to my team. If you want to know more, please go to alliesforme.com or follow me on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.